Hello and welcome to Planet Poetry. My name's Robin Houghton.
And I'm Peter Kenny. In this episode, we feature an interview with Greta Stoddart, talking about her latest Blood Axe collection, Fool. That's a hard word to say, that. Fool.
Particularly for us South Londoners. Well, not you, obviously, Peter, but anyway. Meanwhile, Peter and I have been thinking a bit about self-publishing yet again and how it fits into the poetry publishing landscape that we're in right now. Also, Peter introduces us to Guernsey poet Richard Fleming.
But before all that, let's hear what Greta Stoddart had to say to Robin.
Greta Stoddart's three poetry books, From Anvil and Blood Axe, have won or been shortlisted for many prizes, including the Geoffrey Faber Memorial, Forward, the Roehampton and Acosta Award. Her long radio poem, Who's There?, was BBC Pick of the Week and shortlisted for the Ted Hughes Award. She was shortlisted for the 2021 Bridport Short Story Award and longlisted for the 2022 BBC Short Story Award. Greta lives in Devon, where she teaches for the poetry school. Her fourth book, Fool, was published by Blood Axe in September 2022. Greta Stoddart, welcome to Planet Poetry.
Thank you, Robin.
We're going to be talking about your latest book. Before that, just tell us, where on the planet are you right now?
I am in East Devon, about 6 miles from Lyme Regis and Dorset. We're very close to the Devon-Dorset border. I'm in a valley called the Axe Valley, so quite remote.
Sounds like a beautiful part of the world.
Yeah, I'm very lucky to have found this place. We left Peckham 16 years ago and haven't really looked back, really. It's a big shift, but a really, yeah. a really good shift for us.
Now, on Planet Poetry, we like to start by asking a guest to read a poem. So perhaps you'd like to start with the poem A Glass of Water, please.
Yes, of course. A Glass of Water. So many ways of looking at a glass of water. Why is one clearly not enough? Because there are many ways to look, and it's a different kind of sustenance we're after when we look at a glass of water. And maybe there's no such thing as failure when we look, because our eyes cannot fail us. Or rather, no one can say for sure what it is they're seeing. And yet it's there before our eyes. If we know anything, we know here is a glass in which water lies. Why look at a thing again and again? What are we trying to get right? And though I know it's nothing like the man who tried countless times to make a light bulb, I'd like to hold one of those failures in my hand. See what might be done with it. It might not have anything to do with light.
This idea of so many ways of looking, it's the opening line of the poem, and it is something that you explore throughout the book, isn't it? The harder you look, the harder it is to see what's actually there.
Yes. Well, I think looking is probably central to many poets' practice.
Yes.
It is so much about looking, isn't it? And I think that's sort of a thread that's gone through my collections, as probably many other poets' collections. But particularly in Fool, I think, more than the others, there is this sense of a more conscious kind of looking.
Mm-hmm.
And in a sense, like you say, Robin, the harder you look, or the longer you look, the harder it is to grasp, in a sense, what it is you're actually looking at. And it reminds me, in linguistic terms, of when we say a word over and over and over, its kind of sense drains from it, doesn't it? Something else comes in, it becomes pure sound. And,
yes.
And maybe there's almost a sense of the visual equivalent of that, of just looking and looking and see where it takes you. There's one quote that's always stayed with me from, you know, all the 2 decades I've been writing, is one from Auden, where he says, for him, there are 2 ways of looking. One is a fleeting glance, and the other is sitting there in front of it for 4 hours. looking. And I love this. I love this two quite extremes. In a way, the middle ground is no good at all for a poet. It's got to be the one trigger, if you like, or it's got to be the really profound and absorbing act of looking.
Oh, gosh, yes, that's quite a tall order, isn't it? I have to bear that one in mind, I think. And the language you've got in this poem, the repetition of glass and water. We've got glass as in looking glass, we've got mirrors, we've got windows. And so this kind of obviously reflection, and but also seeing through as well as having something reflected back at you, I thought was really interesting. And towards the end where in this poem, where you say, I'd like to hold one of those failures in my hand and see what might be done with it. And it may be nothing to do with light. I rather like that. It's not a failure. It's something different, I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that is where this looking and also this sense of questioning that sort of follows quick on the heels of looking in this book, by looking more, by questioning more, something is then allowed to transform and become something else that you weren't necessarily expecting.
Now, something I felt was distinctive in a number of the poems was you often start, you know, in media res, as it were, and it's often quite conversational, this as if you're kind of musing on things, either with yourself or with someone else, but in quite a conversational way. It sort of belies the deep thinking that's going on behind the poems, I think. I wonder if you might read How I Come to Clean the Windows.
How I Come to Clean the Windows. So this is how it is, these endless moments that end so quickly. How to tend to them all. See how that wasn't a question. I put it to myself as a quest with a very small cue. This is what happens at a certain point, an easing of ambition, phew. And now just this queasy nonchalance that comes from all the being there each morning to greet the rolling delivery of days. A spider scuttles across the back of my hand. Why ever do I let it? Take it to mean that I mean well, when really it is to me as I am to it, as rain is to the glass. Poor windows, who are so functional and calm, who keep it all in, who keep it all out, who suffer the endless moments of rain. Go, little spider, go. Make a dash for the place you have in your tiny blue mind. For I have these windows to see to. They could be so large and bright.
It's probably worth mentioning you have a couple of epigraphs at the beginning of the book, don't you? One from Jane Hirschfield, and the other one is a few lines from Paul McCartney's A Fall on a Hill. I was trying to remember there was something in T.S. Eliot's Four Quartets. It meant I had to go back and read the whole damn lot again.
no bad thing.
In East Coca, there's this bit where he's saying, in order to arrive at what you do not know, you must go by a way, which is the way of ignorance. So I was thinking this idea of the fool who knows nothing, but actually perhaps knows as much as any of us.
Yes, or knows it differently, perhaps. But yes, absolutely. What comes to mind, Robin, when you say that, is T.S. Eliot's idea of humility. Here's a quote. Humility is the most difficult of all virtues to achieve. Nothing dies harder than the desire to think well of self. Which I think is great, but so not it's not humility in the sense of just being humble about your talents, for example, but a kind of reckoning of the self, of who and what you truly are. Humility is often linked to religion, isn't it? That religious sense of humility, of setting your sense of self against a larger reality or belief. But to return to a more secular kind of humility or self-setting, if you like, I think it can open up a different kind of knowing as you sense yourself in the context of something larger, something maybe you can never know but sense in some way. And I felt a lot of these poems actually swam up to a kind of invisible wall beyond which lay what
I could never know somehow, but they kept sort of persisting in arriving at that place or coming up against that place.
You've had a long career as a poet, and I'm interested in how poets mature and how their themes or their concerns perhaps develop over time. And do you feel that that has been something that has developed? You know, I feel like this is the collection of a mature poet or a mature person.
Yes, of course. I think you're right. But when I look back at the early books, I think there was always a sense of the spiritual or an extra dimension or something.
Something else that came through. I mean, you've got a background in the theatre, haven't you? And I felt, but there are quite a few poems where that actually address the idea of performing. So again, there's this, you know, what's on the surface? Can one perform? And what you are performing is actually reality for the people who are receiving your performance. For example, if you're teaching a workshop and there's a lovely poem where you have a rather frightening person in your workshop and there's this kind of dialogue as to who is the person who knows what they're talking about and who isn't.
Exactly.
Which yeah. I felt, oh God, you know, I think I've been in that position yeah. before. And others where you are, where we are looking at people on a stage. But there's just something about the language. It's often very unsettling, I think.
Yes, I think, this book more than the others sort of touches on my experience as an actor. And I think I found the links more this time. So being on stage and being very much seen, but also hiding behind a character, is in a way like being in a poem, isn't it? Because you're writing, but you're also yeah. hiding behind the writing, and it's now you see me, now you don't. Or, you know, what are you actually seeing? Are you seeing reality? Are you seeing a heightened reality? Are you seeing the real me? Or are you seeing versions of me? You know, so there are many actually parallels.
Now, I wonder if you might read the poem Concord. Now, this is one of those poems that I started reading, and halfway through I started to feel quite unsettled by it, and I think it does so many strange things.
Concord. When actually what I really want to talk about is after the accident, when for a whole year I was carried by my mother to various houses to lie on a sofa for the day. I remember one in particular, which had a small galley kitchen with a woman inside it, clattering around, quite cheerful, I think, always doing something. I suppose she was looking after me. I suppose that is what she was doing, making me a sandwich or something. But what I remember most is watching Concorde take off again and again. It was the first commercial flight, so it was taking off with people inside it, people who had paid to be inside it, eat steak and drink champagne. I didn't know any of that then. All I knew was that it had taken off, which was something they wanted to show us again and again, in order perhaps that we might begin to imagine those inside it, what they were doing and what that might be like. And why wasn't it us inside it? And what had we done with our lives that had led us to the point where we knew in our hearts we'd only ever be the ones to watch and imagine? So let's imagine I'm the woman in the kitchen, clattering around, cutting the bread, asking myself what led me to take in this child lying there without a word, while inside her body, her poor broken bones are slowly coming back together, but ever so slightly differently. And I know, because I do, because I'm the woman in the kitchen now, what's going on for that child, by which I mean anyone who can't help but be broken, as they lie transfixed by the world out there, the way it keeps happening to them and not to them. How there'll always be this trying to mend what's within with all that is without.
So an extraordinary ending, and it's one of those poems where it has a kind of a, not exactly a circular, but certainly a returning again to the beginning structure. But I'm intrigued. I mean, where did this poem come from?
It did begin with a real memory. I did have an accident. This did actually happen, as they say. But it seems strange to me that after all those months of lying on various sofas, one thing that I really remembered was this house where I sat watching Concorde take off on the TV. So sometimes I feel you write to try and understand something. And I think I wanted to try and understand why I had this memory. I also, I think, wanted to understand something about the effects of that accident on me as a child. So I think that was the impulse to write the poem. And then I realized that that moment of looking at the outside of the aeroplane and imagining what was inside the aeroplane, which is echoed later in the poem with a child trying to marry what she is seeing to what she's feeling. It's about a coming together. It's about bringing those two parts of oneself, or maybe even various parts of oneself, together. Because I often feel I'm not together. And I think that maybe goes back to the acting as well, that I've always had this sense of seeing myself live my life. Maybe it's very common. Maybe everyone has that. But people often talk about this detached quality in my poems. And I think because that's how it is for me. And maybe that poem is saying something about how that might have started, or maybe not started, at least the moment when I became aware of it.
That detached quality that I found quite sort of chilling almost. The memory was a woman in a kitchen, no specific person, no memory of who she was or what she looked like, but being described in that way as if you were a director, you know, setting out the stage directions, and the idea of people being paid to be inside Concorde and paid to eat steak or whatever.
Yeah. I think looking back and thinking of my memory, as it were, I'm interested not so much in the real people, as you say, the real woman, the real mother, but almost like they become archetypes in my memory. And I want to understand what they symbolise in my memory, I suppose, which is why I go for this sort of pared down, depersonalised figure in my poems increasingly.
If you would, Greta, I wonder if you would read one of the poems from the middle of the book. I felt it had an emotional feel that was perhaps different from a lot of the other poems in the collection. So I wonder if you'd read that for us, please. Consider the Mornings.
Consider the Mornings. Consider the mornings we've woken into, and you turn to me or I to you, and why it is I still prefer to wake alone. It's something about the light, how it brings a certain clarity of tone after the weight and dread of the night. Consider the night, the one time we see ourselves in space. So wonder what we are, how, for example, the fundamental laws of physics can't explain the on-off beauty of your face, but can how the electricity I find in stroking you is there too in a star. Consider electricity and at the same time the eternal mystery, how science is only possible because of it, how nature likes to complicate itself inside the vast simplicity of its plan. Think eye of an insect, love of a man, how compound and complex. Consider the last time we'll ever have sex, you and I, how we live among things destined to die, that man's love, that insect I. Consider your being destined to die, how of course I'll cry, but at the same time think how different it feels when taken outside, how commonplace and wide. It'll be something about the light compared to how the mind is, so compound and complex. Consider the eternal mystery and how it might be absolutely devoid of love. And yet, how potential is that yet? Consider a temperate, self-possessed approach to disaster. How absurd, and yet potential is that clarity of tone. Consider that tone, the one to take, the morning when, you or I will wake alone, and it'll no longer be a matter of preference, nor will it be a disaster, but commonplace and wide, as you or I will step outside, where something about the light after the weight of the night will make us wonder what we are, and at the same time how electricity in a star is only possible because of the eternal yet vast simplicity of the plan. Think eye of an insect, love of a man.
Thank you. It's beautiful. I love the way that it comes back at the end to the love of a man. And this has got a lot of end rhyme and the rhythm of it as well. Like a lullaby almost, or a prayer. I couldn't decide, but it just felt quite different. Is that fair to say?
I think it is. It is fair, Robin, because this book I was quite interested in sort of pare back. I would just strip the language of stuff. But in that poem, I think I really went with the music and the emotions. And it was interesting. If I read that poem, I felt that link between emotion and music.
There is another one I'm wondering if I might ask you to read, which is the title poem, I suppose, Fool.
Fool. Look at your desk. Can't you see it's had enough of your elbows, your head, your heart? Break it up and feed the fire, for the fool is nothing if not drawn to the bright spark in all dying things. Then let the fool in foolish dress make awkward gestures of tenderness. Let us in this way be entertained in all manner of small mercies. Let us be grateful for them and for the fool who is nothing, if not good. For nothing is what we're good for. Nothing might be what is called for.
One could almost say that there's a sort of nihilistic ending to that one, or maybe nihilistic is too strong, but the repetition of nothing and even the two O's, how the word fool looks like a pair of zeros in the middle of it.
That poem was inspired by a book called The Vision of the Fool by Cecil Collins, who you might know was an artist in the 1930s and 40s. He became fascinated with the figure of the fool, who for him represented an almost religious or mystic figure. And Christ was for him the ultimate fool, someone who was perceived as both marginal and dangerous, but who was ultimately essential, who was the truth, I suppose. But some of his ideas are, well, too ideological for me, and a kind of 20th century William Blake, but so though I found myself disagreeing with a lot of what he said, I was also entranced by it in a way. So it felt like a sort of fruitful kind of disagreement, which got me thinking and feeling. So I think immersing myself in that essay influenced the tone of that poem, Fool, which I think is quite different to the other poems. You know, that line, for example, let us be entertained in all manner of small mercies.
Yes.
You know, it's got a kind of archaic ring to it, which is a bit like the way Colin sometimes wrote. And I like the way that tone seemed to suggest ideas of archetype. And I don't feel the fool as a psychological or real person. Rather, they symbolise something. They are like a state of mind or a state of being.
Yeah.
But also, go to the last line of that poem, the sense of nothing, which I think may have come by way of King Lear's question to Cordelia, nothing will come of nothing, he asks her. You know, he misinterprets her honesty. He takes it personally. In a way, you could say that she's, Cordelia at that moment is speaking like a fool, speaking honestly and without regard to what she might gain.
Yeah.
So I don't find that word nothing nihilistic. I actually find it quite liberating in a strange way. And I don't know. I mean, maybe I find the idea of nihilism quite liberating, and that sense of nothing, or there just being nothing, is a sort of huge relief after everything.
That's one way of looking at it, isn't it? How interesting. A sort of blank page.
Yeah, yes.
Yes, because there was an earlier poem where I got a feel of, you know, tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow creeps in this petty pace from day to day. So
I love that, Robin. I love that. I love that you picked up on that, and then maybe go straight to the quote, and that quote continues. I'm sure you know, that quote goes on, and all our yesterdays have lighted fools the way to dusty death.
Yes.
So I hadn't made that link.
Oh, well, there you are. Subconsciously, you're getting your thespon there, I think. So this fall is this your fourth or your fifth fall collection? Pardon me.
It's my fourth.
And I was really interested in a good way to notice quite big gaps between books. You know, is it like 4 years, 6 years and 6 years or something?
Never four. My God, that's far too speedy for me.
There are poets who regularly would spend 10 years on each book. And I'm just wondering if that's to do just with your practice, or is it you've got lots of other different creative sides? You know, quite often I know people who write both prose and poetry, that when they've done a collection of poetry, that's it for a while on poetry. Is that true for you, or is it just that you like to spend a long time putting something together?
Well, both really, Robin, in that things happen slowly for me, and certainly collections accrue, and I like to let them happen in their natural time, which for me is slow time. But you're right, there is a particularly long gap between Alive, Alive-O and Fool, because I spent 2 years writing a radio piece called Who's There? That was broadcast on Radio 4 in 2017. And that was quite an experience. I spent a year in a residential care home for people with advanced dementia. So I was writing Who's There in between those two books. Mm. And I think now, looking back, I can see how that experience in the care home paved the way for Fool in some way. Mm. That experience of being among people who were literally losing their minds, losing their sense of self anyway, got me thinking more existentially about what being is, about what happens when we come to the end of that being, when that sense of being begins to dismantle. And I think formally it also led in some strange way maybe to the pared down style that I think is evident in the poems in Fool. I felt after Who's There that I wanted to be as clear as I could about something that was really complex. I didn't want the language, and it sounds paradoxical, but I didn't want it to get in the way or to adorn the thinking too much or become self-conscious about itself, just to try for something cleaner.
That's true, actually. I mean, when, you know, my mother had dementia and my mother-in-law is going through that now, that there is a sense of the person, as you say, losing their language and the connections that between words and ideas. And I remember my mother towards the end, she could say something like, "How long?" But she couldn't explain what she meant by that. But I can see how being among people with dementia would perhaps set you off in that direction.
Yeah, I mean, just that phrase, "How long?" You know, is an incredibly resonant phrase. Just being in that place where you had these fragmented utterances, like poetry comes to us, you know, they came almost with their own freighted sense of something.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Now, you were recently a judge for the National Poetry Competition, so that must have been a huge amount of work. I mean, how did you find that on the whole?
When Judith Palmer rang me up and she told me that I would be reading 12,000 poems out of the 18,000 that are entered, I was like, yeah, sure. And I realise I do not process, or I cannot picture what large numbers are in reality. So when the boxes finally arrived, the six enormous boxes, and I actually saw these piles of poems, I thought, am I going to be able to do this? But I thought, well, I've got to do this. So I worked out I'd have to read 265 poems a day for 6 weeks.
Oh, no.
Which does sound almighty, and it is almighty. But once I started reading, it was really surprising how quickly I could recognise what I felt to be a good poem almost before I read it. I can't really explain it, but it's like you pick it up and you see a shape, you maybe just pick out a bit of a line.
Yeah.
And so I went through them quicker than I thought I would. Because the good poems are rare, and somehow they come with their own other sort of energy that was quite easy to spot once I got into the flow of it.
It still sounds like a sort of mammoth task, and I'm sure everyone's very grateful that you and others take on that role for these big competitions.
Well, it is, you know, it is a great privilege.
That's good. And I know the Poetry Society, it's a big thing for them, and I think for a lot of people who take part. So I don't know why it's called the National Poetry, though. Why is it the international? You know, I mean, it is international.
I think its name needs to change. I mean, you know, the poem is wonderful, coming from all over, but I think it does need to change, especially as we gave the first prize, as you know, to an American which we were delighted about.
So, is there anything that you're working on at the moment that you want to share with us, or what are you writing poetry at the moment, or have you got other projects on the go?
Well, it was interesting. I don't know if it was the experience of judging the National Poetry Competition, but after that, I had no desire, as you can imagine, to read another poem, let alone write one. and I had the last few years, I have been writing prose. You know, I never thought I would. I was one of these people who said, "Oh no, only poems for me." Yeah. But I have been writing these short stories, and I'm really into those at the moment. So who knows where they'll go, but that's what I'm doing. I'm not writing poetry just for the moment.
It's been wonderful reading your book and hearing you read from it and talking about it. There is one poem I'd love you to read as a final farewell to the book, and that is "My Life Came Up to Me and Said." And you might want to introduce it a little bit before you read it.
I think, as we've touched on a bit, this book is about a kind of reckoning, and I think this poem that I'm about to read, the speaker is in a sense taking stock of her life as it's passing by and saying, kind of, you know, it's been a good life, I've been lucky, and trying to, in modern parlance, own that, you know, to own the sense, to recognize that you have been lucky. That you may have been tested, but not nearly as much as so many other people on this planet have. A return to that humility, I suppose. My life came up to me and said, "I want to ask you about courage. It wasn't a good time. I was kneeling at the iris bed. I'd been waiting weeks to do this, to not think about anything but the irises and my need to free them of all the nettles and wild grasses, my need to cut a border, look out the window and feel a deep satisfaction at the sight of the dark, dug-over soil, broken now and open, ready for the rain to enter, for the green sheaths to push up, unfurl their purple flags to the air. Do you think you have more because of the years, or less?" And I looked at my life as I have always done, askance, sceptical, and said, "I'm not sure I ever had it. I'm not sure you asked for it. Things happened that made me sad as the next person, but my choices were clear to me, and I was always able to make them. Do you know how lucky you are?" my life said, placing a hand on my shoulder as I looked down and scraped my trowel with a stick. I have no idea why the tears came. I didn't know who to thank, or if even thanks were due. Surely not to my life, who, I could see now, was simply passing by.
It's a lovely way to finish your reading, I think, because it does have this spiritual element to it. And again, this dialogue that we've talked about in some of the other poems, am I right in saying, kind of has a redemptive feel to it?
Yeah, and a kind of give thanks in a way. But then who do you give thanks to if you're not religious? You know, you give thanks to this life that's, you know, going to end. So I just wanted to, I think I was in that sense of that energy of being both there and knowing that you're not going to be there.
There is also this, you know, you're weeding at the time. You're fingers in the soil. We've had this conversation on a podcast before with Janet Sutherland, I think it was. You know, getting your hands in the soil, and somehow that kind of gives you that sense of having come from the clay, as it were. Another motif that is in several of the poems. That, you know, was it for this the clay grew tall? I really like that. Reminiscent of Heaney with his digging.
Yeah, that's certainly true, Robin. And there's lots of sort of earthy and landy and fields in this book. And I think for me, you know, if there is a religion of any kind, it is a touching the earth. It is gardening. It is, you know, it is being in touch with all that we are on, that we are part of.
Well, it's a lovely book, and it's called Fall, published by Blood Axe. Thanks so much for coming on, Greta Stoddart.
Thank you, Robin, for inviting me.
So what Greta was talking about really resonated with me. I love that glass of water poem. The way looking at things is part of what she's interested in. And repeated lookings, like that poem with Concord in it, for example. You know, she's sitting on a sofa, injured, watching the same thing taking off all the time. And it becomes weirdly transformed.
Yes, like the longer you look at something, the more it kind of disappears almost. That was an extraordinary poem, wasn't it? This she describes as her pared back style is quite noticeable through the book, and I really liked it, but it is chilling sometimes, you know.
Mm. She talked about at one point about mending what is within versus the pressure of the outside world and external events, and that really resonated with me as well. But I also thought about actors I've known, and you know, she's worked in theatre. They face that idea lots, you know, the difference between what they're presenting and what they're actually feeling on the inside, you know.
Yes.
There is that kind of method thing of really trying to be, just transform your whole body and become this new thing. It's always a tension with every actor I've known, that kind of exhaustion as well of playing a particular part on stage, and then you get off stage and you kind of just want to crawl into a shell if you've been a bully or something, you know, on stage.
Well, that's true. And in fact, she talked, didn't she, about how her acting sort of has threaded itself in.
Mm.
And there are one or two poems that obviously were her or the narrator, whoever, leading a workshop and being the tutor and being the expert. And as soon as you put yourself in front of a group of people, you are saying that you're the expert on that topic, aren't you? And many more of us who've not been actors have yet been in that position where indeed you are acting, aren't you? You have to act that part.
Yeah.
Quite often.
She talked a couple of times about this idea of humility, which I think she pulled out from
T.S. Eliot.
T.S. Eliot.
Yeah.
Possum. That's an idea that I really agree with and have thought about quite a lot. And one of the things, I may have said this before, one of my conclusions from that idea of humility is not trying to make yourself look good as a writer. You know, this idea of you don't want people to read your poems and think, that chap is a really nice bloke, you know. You want to actually be interested. You know, yeah. So that idea of not trying to impress people by, you know, your virtues, but by telling the truth and having that humility to, you know, make yourself look a bit of an idiot sometimes or whatever.
Yeah. And she tied that in, didn't she, with this idea of the fool is the ultimate humble person, really, because they have no knowledge, therefore they are open to anything that comes their way. That book by Cecil Collins, I thought that sounded fascinating.
Yeah, my old art teacher used to go on about, I did A-level art, and my art teacher used to talk about Christ the clown.
Ah.
Maybe he got it from this source, that this idea that Christ is often depicted as a fool or a clown. So, yeah, I'd completely forgotten about that until Greta started talking about it. The ideas and her preoccupations I find very sympathetic to the things I'm interested in. And I like that kind of spirituality, you know, that poem, Consider the Mornings.
That's beautiful, isn't it?
I love how she kind of wrong-foots you every now and again. You know, this. She talks about the morning, and then she says something like, I prefer to wake alone. You know, there's this romantic tone, but then she's saying she wants to wake up on her own. And I felt that poem, you know, my life came up to me and said, I want to ask you about courage. What I love is when a poem just instantly overcomes prejudices, because I thought, oh my God, my life came up to me and said something, you know, and it's just like, and I just, this is just going to be a turkey. But actually, it really worked so well, you know, and she made it work and made it fresh. And that's a tribute to such an excellent writer.
Yeah, yeah.
You went through all the stars and the galaxies and things, and you end up back with a sort of insect's eye and the love of a man.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of really domestic, tiny things.
Yes.
Yeah. It's sort of a huge journey, an expansive journey into silence and the world and the night and everything, you know, a fabulous kind of mystical trip in a way.
Yes. Multifaceted work, I think. And
yeah.
I think that's partly what I was getting at when I said it felt like the work of a mature writer, you know. If she had preoccupations when she started out writing, she's worked through them, and now she's more humble in that sense of humility. I think she's more open for that,
and the confidence to write more simply in a way. She said after that experience of, you know, writing her radio play and being with people with dementia and so on,
yes,
that kind of sense of a kind of clarity and simplicity, even though her ideas are complex.
Yes.
I always respond to that kind of writing too.
Yeah.
So great. What a great guest. Lovely poems. And a book's called Fool from Blood Axe, is it?
It is, yeah. Fool. Yes, published last September.
So we were invited to speak to creative writing students at Brighton University last week, weren't we?
We were. Yeah, that was interesting. Really interesting. They're all very young, and it's exciting because they're at the start of their careers, and they probably looked at us oldsters. I'd rather not know what they thought. But I mean, you know, one has experience to offer. So it was interesting to hear what they were doing, and hopefully they found it useful what we talked about.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things we were talking about was reaching audiences, and some of them had, you know, were full of ideas about what they were doing, you know, live performance perhaps, and using the socials to get their message across and so on.
Yeah, yeah.
So one of the things that cropped up was this idea of self-publishing. I don't think we went into it too much, but I've been thinking about self-publishing. In fact, you and I have been talking about it a lot lately.
Yeah.
And it sort of makes me think, what are the best ways to use self-publishing, if, you know, counterintuitively, is if you've already been published, because there isn't that sense of, like, you know, I'm publishing this because nobody else will publish me.
Yes, it's a shame that there is still a bit of that stigma. I think it's less than it used to be.
Definitely.
I mean, when we started Telltale Press, it felt like something different, but I think now there are quite a lot of, you know, like self-funded presses, cooperative presses, very, very small presses set up for the publication of, you know, someone and their you know, their
besties.
Besties or the poets that they work with, and they, which is, you know, that's nothing wrong with that. And a lot of magazines actually are run along those lines, let's be honest.
And sort of things like GoFundMe pages and so on, you know, people reaching out to potential audiences for funding.
Something that came across actually with the students, that quite a few of them we saw, didn't we, some of the exhibition of their end of coursework.
Yeah.
And there was quite a lot of hybridity.
Definitely.
Artwork, you know, a range of poems, maps, all kinds of creative material that was not just lines on a page.
Yeah. I think one of the things that is becoming increasingly clear is that it's no longer that dichotomy, you know, a sort of a serious publisher publishes your work or you self-publish it. The whole thing's blurred now. And the fact that people have risen to prominence by, you know, like Brian Bilson, whose poems are all over the internet and, you know, regularly posted on Facebook pages and so on, really have risen to prominence just by through the medium of social media.
Right.
So, and talking to those people just on the cusp of their beginning their careers, you just think, yeah, the stage looks completely different to when we were starting.
Yeah.
That presents opportunities.
We've certainly seen, we've had guests on who've self-published little pamphlets in between collections with the big guys. So your point about if you're already published, you're kind of freer to do something that you want to do on your own. And sometimes the big publishers, for whatever reason, don't want to take whatever it is you're now offering. It's not quite their house style.
Yeah. Well, in my own experience, I did a collection in 2010 called the Guernsey Double, and it was with my friend Richard Fleming, who's an excellent poet who lives on the island. I really believe in this build it and they will come kind of idea. So we kind of put this idea together of having a two-person collection. I lived there as a child, and it was my recollections of childhood in Guernsey. And Richard wrote about having almost fled there from living in Ulster and in Belfast, you know, to a place of calmness and tranquility. And it was like two sides of the same coin, so we called it a Guernsey Double. But we had this idea, and then we, in talking to the Guernsey Arts Commission about what we were doing, they got behind it, because there was at that time no publisher in Guernsey that would be prepared to do that.
Gosh, interesting.
But, you know, if you do it yourself, or if you say you're going to do it, then suddenly people got behind it. And we were very much supported by the Arts Commission there, you know, financially and in helping us to arrange readings and all kinds of things. So it turned into a really big success. But I think, you know, if it doesn't exist, if the infrastructure doesn't exist, you know, why not do it yourself?
Absolutely. And that was the advice we got when we started Telltale.
Yeah.
From Carol Ann Duffy. She was a tutor on a course that I went on, and a lot of us were in the same position of desperate to get something published, you know, with the press. And she said, well, if you can't do that, why not just get together? Maybe two or three of you get together to publish your own pamphlets, and that can be the stepping stone to introducing you to a bigger publisher. So that was our ethos, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. Well, what got me thinking about this was Richard has produced a collection of selected poems, despite having a good track record in being published and, you know, several collections published, including most recently in 2017, a collection called Stone Witness, which was published by Blue Orma Publishing, which is a Channel Islands publisher. He's had a sort of slim, beautifully produced slim volume of his selected poems published. And I'd just like to read a couple of them out, because I think he's an excellent poet, and he's a kind of exemplar of, you know, this kind of hybrid approach. And it's of necessity, because, you know, there isn't a publishing scene out in the Channel Islands.
Mm.
And a lot of what he writes isn't for an English audience in a way, you know, that there is that sense of a lot of it being rooted in the island culture there.
Mm-hmm.
I've chosen two very short poems that are sort of more general. One's called Shadow Play. The shadow creatures conjured there on bedroom walls, the dove, the hare, by fathers, mothers, dexterously for girls and boys, must surely be no different from the shadow beasts that shamans, tribal chiefs and priests made dance by firelight on cave walls, while others, wrapped in skins and shawls, knelt silent in a state of bliss, enthralled by magic such as this.
Oh, I like that.
He's got a very strong attachment, increasingly as he's matured, to rhyme. And a lot of his later poems are kind of quite rhymed, which he admits is unfashionable, but he really enjoys.
But so what? But that one particularly had a sense of being sort of like an incantation, which suited its subject.
And another one, Suitcases, is a poem about his father. Crouching in attic gloom, where skylight beams illuminate their pools of silver dust, old leather suitcases doze like alligators, dreaming their prehistoric dreams. They sleep soundly, having eaten up my father's life. The photographs, the hearing aid and collar studs, the safety razor with its rusted blade, the letters and the wallet with the ticket stubs. Yet I am so afraid that when I kneel beneath the skylight to prise apart those sagging alligator jaws, the life that I will find compressed within will be too small to match my memories of him.
Hmm.
So just a lovely, I love that poem. Yeah. It's just that sort of wrestling with a strange alligator in an attic. Richard's a fine example of how you mix, you know, being traditionally published with self-publishing.
Yeah.
Due to necessity, really. But he's extremely well regarded in the Channel Islands. And in my opinion, the best poet living in Guernsey by a country mile.
Hmm. Interesting. Always interesting to hear about poets from other parts of the planet. And lovely that you had that, you created that collection with him as well.
Yeah.
When we said we were going to talk about self-publishing, I thought, oh, let me look through my bookshelf to see what I've got, any little gems. And it's funny, a couple of things occurred to me. Do you remember the Poetry Book Fair, which has gone a little bit into a hiatus, I think, possibly since the pandemic?
Yeah.
That used to be a great place to go and pick up funny little pamphlets from micro presses.
Mm.
Where do you draw the line between a micro press and self-publishing? You know, does that, I'm not quite sure really, but, and I look and I think, are some of these even still going? A little pamphlet here called The Borrowed Notebook by Chris McCabe, published by Landfill Press in 2009. One hopes that hasn't gone into the landfill, but I couldn't find any trace of it on the web. And I also would like to give a shout out to Anne Perrin.
Oh, yes.
She and her family and her forebears were all puppeteers. I mean, serious Punch and Judy, marionettes. There's nothing she doesn't know about that whole business. And in a way, it's kind of something that's gone almost. You know, she's like a living museum of that whole subject. Fascinating.
Yeah.
And she writes for children as well. And I've got this lovely book that she obviously got some funding for. Now, this is interesting, isn't it? This booklet has been produced as part of the Dry Stone Walling Association Education Project, funded by the Heritage Lottery Fund.
Yes.
The Dry Stone Walling Association Education Project. I mean, who knew there was such an organisation? One can find funding from the most unusual places if you're writing about a particular topic. And this book is called The Hole in the Wall. And it's a lovely, lovely book with Anne's words and illustrations. Very talented woman. So I treasure that one.
Yeah, she had a collection called The Puppeteer's Daughter, I think.
Ah, was that memoir? I think I know she's writing memoir as well.
Ah,
so,
yeah.
Yeah, could be.
So our conclusion from all this is that...
Oh, yes.
Don't...
Have we got one?
Just don't let anybody stop you. As writers, we often have these kind of little projects which don't quite fit anywhere, but you love, and
yeah,
and just want to put them out into the world, even in this, just release them into the wild somehow.
And you can, can't you? Yeah, yeah, you can, because how many pamphlets does one sell anyway, whether it be published with a publisher or self-published? You sell them at readings quite often, don't you? And at readings, people love something that's been hand-created or something limited edition. That creates a desire, I think.
Especially for people that have got a kind of a lust for stationery.
That's right. Better not go any further down that route.